This week on Writers, Inc.
Between the picture books and the novels that I write, there are some consistencies, actually, between the two. For example, I do this thing we call story mapping, where I'm basically plotting the story. And I started doing that with picture books, where I would do this kind of a flow chart to figure out the sequence of events for my picture book.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I'm scrambling right now. We kind of talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but I've got a trip to Greece tomorrow. There's a Facebook group of thriller fans that's just a little shy of 2 million members strong. It's a really big group. And every year they do these retreats where they take a couple of authors and they fly out to, you know, some really cool remote place of the world. And, you know, we hang out for like a week with people that can go from the group and a couple of, you know, writers. It's one of those things, like it always sounds fantastic when I agree to these things. But then like when the day comes and all of a sudden, you know, like I've got to scramble, because I'm going to be gone for 10, 12 days from the house and trying to knock out all these things, like it's a lot. Like, do you guys feel that
my entire life?
When trips come up. So I'm not alone in that.
No, I'm always like, yeah, that sounds great. Oh, it's so much fun. And like, you know, when it's a month out, I'm so excited about it and looking forward to it. And then it happens and I'm like, is it too late to cancel? I don't really want to. Like, can we just not do it?
Yeah. And, you know, Kara's been going with me to more author conferences the past couple of years. And I think she's finally starting to see why I always hedged when she would say, hey, why don't I tag along on this? Because we don't see each other. Mm-hmm. It's not like we're on vacation. Right. I'm not going to be sitting there waiting, you know, until you get up and then we go down to the beach or any of that. It's, you know, I'm on the whole time. So
yeah,
it's so disruptive to everything. So
yeah. Well, that's the other piece of this, right? Because I was really hoping my wife and daughter would go. And one of the reasons why these people booked the trip for June is because my daughter is out of school. Like, we were planning on bringing her. But my daughter, you know, she's 7. She still doesn't have a passport, which is on me and my wife. Like, we just haven't gotten one. And, you know, like, we talked about it. And, like, every time it came up, well, we got 6 months. We've got 5 months. We've got 4 months. We've got 2 weeks. You know, so now it's too late for that. And Kevin, just like you pointed out, you know, like, you get to these things and like it may be a vacation for them, but I'm not going to be able to spend a whole lot of time with them because I'm getting pulled in other directions. And that's, you know, I'm there because of the people that are doing the pulling, you know, so you have to figure that out too. So,
yeah.
And my daughter right now, like, she complains about a trip to like Walmart, which is 2 minutes down the street. So I can't imagine her, you know, sitting still on a plane for 11 hours or 12 hours or whatever this is going to be.
Right. Yeah.
I'm the worst. I just like being at home. I would never go anywhere if my husband didn't make me go. He's like, you're going. I'm like, okay. But I'm never looking forward to it. But I always have fun when I get there. So hopefully you'll have fun when you get there.
Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I get there and I'm like, wow, this is really no fun. I would really rather be anywhere but here.
I think
that's happened a few times.
I like the idea of, you know, like back, you know, like the 1800s when like you would like summer someplace, you know, it's like you get there and then it's like, you're not going anywhere for a while. So there's no like rush and there's no like, oh, we have to do this. And then you get back and then you're just as tired because you crammed everything into this like week long trip. Like I think that we should bring back the idea of summering places.
I just had a visual of, you know how hard it is to get a carry on bag on the airplane. I could just see somebody like traveling with those big wooden steamer trunks.
Today's world. That was one of the things that was really nice about when we were doing the whole van life thing, though, was we eventually got into a groove. Was like, we were in a new place, but we have our routines. You know, we had our space, we had our stuff. You know, and everything was with us. And so it was kind of that vibe, like, we're summering here. This is
where we happen to live. They have an RV. And so they'll do that when they go places. It's a little bit nicer because you don't have to rush. Yeah. That's the hard part.
Get to use my toilet. My shower.
Right.
No.
Well, yeah, and sleep in your own bed, right? You know, like
Yeah.
that's a big part of this whole thing too. Like,
Yeah.
Yeah.
all right, I'll stop whining about going to Greece now.
Yeah.
Yeah, JD.
Speaking of first world
Sorry.
problems,
Yeah.
let's get to the news. Print royalty rate and paperback printing cost changes. On June 10th, Amazon lowered the royalty rate for certain print books, specifically books priced at $9.98 or less USD, now earn 50% royalties instead of 60%. This applies to both paperback and hardcover formats, but not ebooks. If your print books are priced under $9.99, you are now earning less per sale. Additionally, books that moved to the 50% royalty rate also have a higher minimum list price. If your current price falls below that new threshold, you could earn nothing at all per sale.
Yeah.
So,
these things always favor the
The
house.
minimum, I was looking it up. The minimum depends on your pages and format. So they have a calculator on there that you can go calculate what you need to be at minimum to make anything now with the changes. So,
Yeah.
And this
wow.
is strictly KDP, right?
Yeah, this is just KDP, specifically KDP print.
Print.
Uh,
Just print.
and yeah, I only had like one book that was impacted by this because I used KDP print for one of my nonfiction books, I think. So I all I did was change the price, but it annoys me though, because this is kind of the way it always goes with Amazon. It's like, oh, we're taking a hit, so the people that will be impacted will be the authors. We're going to make sure that you get less money unless you play by this rule.
That's business all around. I
I
mean,
get
that's
it.
any business does that. Not that it helps or makes it right, but that is, I mean, that's how prices go up everywhere, right?
To an extent, that's true, but like, and I know that companies like Walmart will often dictate like minimum pricing and things for actually what they generally dictate is like the margin for a product, right? So we must make a certain margin, and you can price whatever you want as long as they get that. But this is a lot like, Walmart dictating to the manufacturer of something, like you will price it at this, and you will get this amount in margin, that.
Yeah, I mean, like, usually though, like, I mean, some businesses will say that they don't pass the cost on to the consumer, but eventually it does get passed on to the consumer, whether they're open about it or not. Like, and I guess that's kind of what happens here. It's just that there's less of a supply chain when it comes to an author to the consumer. Somewhere like Walmart, you have like multiple stops along the way, so it's a little bit easier to.
Well, yeah, it is really a false comparison, honestly, because in this case, Amazon has some overhead involved. So,
Yeah,
they do get a
I
say
know.
if they're losing money because all your books are priced under a certain amount and they don't get it, whatever. I mean, they do get some say in
Well,
that.
are they losing money though? Because if you think about the way that KDP screen, the pricing screen works, you plug in whatever your sales price is, it tells you what your print cost is, and then it literally lights up in red and black, if you're
Yeah, that's a good
below.
point. Yeah.
And they've raised their print prices too. I've noticed that, because this is a weird price target, because $9.99 is one of those, subconscious, things. Like, it's cheaper because it's less than $10. So now all of a sudden, if you're pricing at $10.99, it's way more expensive than something at
Yeah.
$9.99. You know what
Well,
I
now
mean?
I'm
It's
back
just, it
to being
seems
mad.
cheaper.
Thanks, JD.
I mean, well, I don't know. You like normally when I price these things out, like I tend to I ramp everything up by like $3. So if my print cost is $6.94, then my I'll round the price of my book up to $9, $9.94 or something. Now I'm gonna have to go a little bit higher just because of that. So I think if you think the way this is gonna play out, it's gonna force all indie authors to raise their prices, which is gonna make them, more
They can still
competitive
be
with
at
the traditional books.
$9.99, right?
Well, they can, but nobody is, right? Everybody's gonna go higher. So their books are, indie authors are gonna be priced in the same place as the traditional guys. So they're basically gonna be losing, one of the edges that indie authors had, because indie authors have always priced cheaper.
I think the real
Now
answer
they're
here,
the
though,
same.
is use someone other than Amazon's KDP for your print, because
Oh yeah, no, that's the better way. I mean, and there are, we should probably do a show just on this, because, even with Ingram, you can print in bulk, and that really gets your cost down. You just
Yeah,
warehouse the
bulk
copies
is.
somewhere.
I was going to
Yeah.
ask if KDP is like literally like they're printing like one book at a time, because then those higher prices do make sense.
Yeah.
Like that's hard.
It's that straight up POD model.
It
You
is,
know,
yeah.
they're not warehousing copies. Although some people are through Amazon, and that's why you end up with these weird, like, you know, here's my $10 book selling for $900. You know,
Right.
that happens too. But yeah, no, they're literally it goes into a run. It's kind of interesting to watch. If you ever get a chance to go tour one of these facility printers that does POD, like sometimes you'll have like an array of books, different books printing on one run, but they all have to kind of fit, like it all has to use the same kind
Yeah.
of paper and the same size covers and things like that. But
A lot of those
really
places
interesting.
are in Las Vegas. When you flip to the back of the book, it'll say printed in Las Vegas. Weirdly, I don't know why, but I have noticed that that seems to be a trend.
That is interesting. Well, speaking of trends, see, I do that, and the story has nothing to do with trends, but or does it? The vicious cycle, that could be considered a trend. The vicious cycle of book publishing. 25 plus years veteran of the publishing industry, Kathleen Schmidt explained book publishing cycles in her latest Substack post. As we approach the halfway point of the year, she explained what happens with most big publishers at this point every year and why. Mid-year is gut check time for Big Five imprints. They decide whether they are comfortably on target or scrambling for extra revenue. Shortfalls trigger gap fill moves, where editors hunt for finished or nearly finished manuscripts they can crash onto a fall list, shift on early ready spring book forward, or acquire quick hit titles. Anything that can ship before December 31 and count toward the annual unit goal. Over acquiring is baked into the system because tomorrow's breakout backlist titles can't be predicted. Imprints routinely buy more books than they can fully market. Some titles are published with the quiet hope they'll simply add a few thousand units to the tally. Authors feel the ripple effect. A June budget review can upgrade a mid-list book if the house needs it, or push a big launch back if numbers are already met. Watching for concrete marketing plans by early summer and asking your agent to press for them helps you gauge whether you're a priority or a placeholder. Ouch.
This whole article was interesting. Like, it's really long. It's worth going in and reading. I know we've talked about backlist before, that backlist is where the publishers make their profit, but this just again is highlighting that backlist sales can underwrite frontline efforts, which I find
Yeah. Well,
interesting and I don't know, disheartening, I guess.
there are ways for authors to capitalize on this, because I've had friends that have gotten these phone calls. You know, like if you're one
Yeah.
of those authors where you go through a very rigorous process before you turn in your book, you know, so it doesn't need edits anymore. It doesn't really need copy edits. It's just, it's almost a finished product by the time you turn it in. You're going to be on that phone call list, you know, so because they are looking for these things because they don't have time to do all that stuff. But if you regularly turn in books that don't need all of that work, they know that you're a go-to person. Where you can give them a book, they might, you know, have to spend maybe a week or two on it, and then they can get it right in the pipeline. I know a lot of authors that used to churn out a lot of titles and make a little extra dough on that because, you know,
Yeah.
they'd slip in two or three titles, you know, a lot of times under different pen names because these are the kind of people that write really fast and really clean.
Yeah.
But you know, you can take advantage of this.
Yeah, I was gonna say it doesn't always have to be a bad thing. I mean, even if you're not like a known name, I mean, it could be the thing that gets you, published faster, which isn't, I mean, marketing budgets are kind of crazy, but you can always capitalize on that and you can always push that. It's getting on the lists and getting out there and getting your book out there and developing the relationship with the editor and all those things that can help. And like JD said, if like the editor like knows that you're a go-to and it does decent sales, like that could be the thing that actually helps your,
So do you think it's
consistent.
worthwhile to, if you know, because I see that as a strategy that a lot of the people in the sort of indie author space could probably benefit from. But like, if you went and sort of marketed yourself in a way to agents and publishers as you know, I'll be your Huckleberry, I'll be your placeholder. Do you think that's worthwhile?
I think that it's always worth getting on base.
I don't think you could market yourself that way, because it's more about, proof of concept. So if you've already turned in two or three books, and your agent have seen, had like zero, comments on it, your editor has had to do very little work, you end up at basically a word of mouth, kind of thing going on at the publisher. Another thing you can do, and this is probably more for the trad world too, but if you're like a series author, and you typically put in your one book a year and your series, and that's the thing the publisher expects from you, this is a very good time to slip in that secondary project that you've been wanting to write, or maybe you did write and it's sitting on your hard drive somewhere and you're trying to figure out when to release it. Call your editor, call your agent, later in the year, like after June 1st, and kind of bring up, hey, I've got this, young adult book that I put together. Just see where that goes, because they're more likely going to, jump on it the second half of the year versus first half of the year, I guess is what I'm getting at.
I guess I would just say that, like if you kind of take like the good and the bad out of it and like, everything can be an opportunity, like it doesn't have to be a bad thing.
That's
Like
the
it
way I
can
see it.
be what it is and you can
Look, the
take advantage of
moral
that.
is write more books. That's the moral.
That is the
Write more
moral.
books.
Trying. I'm trying, Kevin.
Next up, BookCon will return in 2026. ReadPop will launch the fan-centric book festival BookCon on April 18th through 19th, 2026 in New York, 5 years after shelving it during the pandemic shutdowns. Jenny Martin says the new BookCon won't resemble the old industry-facing Book Expo. It's purely for readers, not a trade show. Expect signings, panels, sprayed edge workshops, swaps, cosplay-friendly fantasy ball, and other fandom-first programming. ReadPop credits the explosive growth of TikTok and Instagram bookish communities for the decision to revive the show, aiming squarely at Gen Z and millennial women. Consultant Lynn Vlahos has begun courting publishing houses and promises submission guidelines for author appearances and panels next week as ReadPop tops its Comic-Con mailing list to jumpstart early ticket sales.
I
Taps
think
is
this
what I
is
meant to say.
fantastic. They Book Expo was like the week ahead of BookCon, but BookCon was largely like people went to it. People went crazy for it, and it was like the book convention of the year. I know in the bookish community, like Bookstagram, people were devastated that it wasn't coming back. So I think this is fantastic.
See, this, I'm gonna take this full circle, because this is how it happens. Like I'm looking at this, I'm like, hey, that sounds like a lot of fun. I want to go to that. So like I'm gonna probably reach out to somebody. They're gonna be like, oh yeah, we'd love to have you. And before you know it, that's all lined up. And then in April, I'm like, oh crap, I got to go to New York. But this actually sounds like a very fun thing to go to. So I never went to it before in any of the
Really?
iteration. Yeah, so
I
I
went
might give it
the
a shot.
year before the final year. So, and it was a lot of fun. Like you'll just be like standing around, and then all of a sudden there's like a secret drop happening. And like maybe you get the book or maybe you don't, but it's like, there's like scavenger hunts and like people are going around and there's author signings and it's just it's a lot of fun. And because it's like in the center of, it's at Javits, so it's publishing's Mecca. You end up with like agents and editors and just it's just wonderful.
The vibe I
I'm
get
just
from
so
this is
happy it's back.
it's a lot like, because I've done in the past, I've done like Comic Cons, things like that. And there's an energy to that, because you're there because the fans are there. And it's really a good opportunity to be discovered by new fans, but only if you can, you gotta have that sort of carnival barker energy going, wherever you are. You gotta be able to draw them in, which I like to do. So I need to be going to more of these.
It is sort of like the Comic-Con, but it's just for books. Like Comic-Con has like their bookish stuff at it, but like this is just like it's pure books. And then because, it's like the one place, like some conventions might have some agents and might have some editors, but like I think almost all of them go or did at least, the ones in New York. Like it was very rare that you would not just accidentally bump into an industry professional. So I it's worth it if
So are
you
we
can
all
go.
going,
Jenna?
I
think
think
we need a Writer's Inc.
maybe.
presence at this
I
thing,
think
right?
we
There we
do.
go.
I think we do.
Maybe.
It's decided.
You can lure me out of my cave with very few things, but BookCon might be
Yay.
it.
I want a secret drop. I don't even care what it is. I just want someone to secret drop me something.
Yeah, they're just fun. Like you could just happen to be standing at the table and all of a sudden they'll just be like, "Do you want to get in line for this?" And you're like, "Okay." I'm
I
sure.
want to set off like the alarms, like, you're the 100th customer. I want stuff like that to happen. Secret drop.
I'm bringing an
Yeah.
air horn.
Perfect.
Bring your air horn. You've got all the like fancy signage and stuff too, where you've got like the spinning signs and all that stuff.
I do, yeah. Like I bought this thing at Author Nation in Vegas, and like it's literally still sitting in the box in my office. I haven't taken it out yet, but I need to figure out how this thing works because it's like a 3D hologram something or other, and I'm sure we'll
Oh
end up using it at
yeah.
some point.
I
Yeah.
remember when you bought that. Did you buy more than one of them so you can
I
make
bought
it like,
three of them because you can
yeah.
sync them all together. So like all three boxes are piled up right over there.
Cool.
Oh.
All right. So the trick is hang out with JD at this thing.
That's it.
Yep.
I'll be your I ironically, I can be your barker, JD.
Perfect.
Hey, this is Kevin Tomlinson. It seems to me like you might need a little help. Maybe hand off all that stuff that's keeping you from writing. At Author Anchor, we connect authors with skilled, affordable virtual assistants trained specifically for the publishing world. Your personal VA handles everything from book production to marketing and social media, freeing you up to focus on what matters most, your writing. Book a discovery call today and we'll find that perfect VA for you. Plus, mention the Writers Inc. podcast and you'll get $50 off your first month. Visit authoranchor.com and get matched with your personal VA so you can just write.
On that note, JD, who is that this week?
This week we've got Peter Brown on. Peter's the New York Times bestselling author of the Wild Robot Children series, the first of which spawned a fantastic movie. His latest book is called The Wild Robot on the Island and releases June 24th. He's one of the most successful children's authors working today. I am honestly very excited to hear this one. Here he is, Peter Brown.
Well, welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, we've got a lot to talk about today. Very popular movie, old books, new books. But before we dive into that, we like to always start at the beginning and ask, what is your writer origin story? How did you get started writing?
I came to writing through illustration, actually, because I always loved art as ever since I was a little kid, like most kids, once I could pick up a crayon, I was like drawing pictures. But for whatever reason, I just kept drawing, while other kids kind of moved on to other interests, I stayed with art
Yeah.
and drawing. And the things I liked to draw were like characters, doing things like an alien rock band, right, playing on stage, or like a monkey detective, or it was always like these quirky little characters and stuff. I loved cartoons, I loved books when I was a kid, and so I was just kind of mimicking sort of the stuff I was seeing. At the time, I didn't think of that as like storytelling, but looking back on it now, I could see how that was the early days of me becoming a storyteller, inventing characters and putting them in little situations. And so, I didn't actually start writing until later, probably when I was in high school. I took some creative writing classes, and then to college, I went to art school and studied illustration, but took some creative writing classes in college. So I was starting to realize that I wanted to combine words and pictures somehow, and eventually took a children's book class, like a picture book class, and really felt like I was getting close to what I wanted to do. Like there's something about the balance of words and pictures in a picture book in particular versus like comics or graphic novels or animation or whatever. There's something about the picture book format that really felt right to me for my sensibilities, the kinds of stories and characters I was coming up with. And so I started taking writing more seriously at that point and made picture books for a while, which of course is real writing, but eventually moved on to longer form with my Wild Robot series as my first novel. So now I'm an illustrator who sometimes writes novels also.
Yeah, I think that is so interesting. what you just said about how picture books in particular, like the art works with the story. I mean, in graphic novels, it sort of does, but you are right. It's not necessarily quite the same because kids need the pictures as much as they need the words for that context. That's a really interesting type of storytelling. It's very
Well, and the young age felt fun too, right? The readers being typically picture books are like 4 to 8 year olds. They're especially the 6, 7, 8 year olds, they're old enough to get my jokes. They're old enough to get some of the subtler things that are happening in the story, but they still are young. They still have big imaginations. And the younger kids, may not understand every little nuance, but they're in it for the big, interesting pictures, and the illustrations. So, I don't know. There's something really fun about that age group where you can do a lot. Obviously, there's real limitations on what content and vocabulary and stuff like that. But it's a really fun age to work to create for, and that was part of the appeal to me. It was like it's a fun audience. And actually doing events, I didn't know this at the time, but I spent a lot of time doing events, bookstore events, libraries, school visits, that kind of thing. And like I said, I didn't know this before I got published, but I do a lot of that stuff, and they're such a fun audience when you're actually in person with them versus adults, right? Like I've done events like for adults, and adults are cool, I guess, but kids are awesome, right? Like kids are so fun because they actually laugh out loud. They're not inhibited. They just, where you stand. And if you're bombing, you know that too, right? Because they'll yawn loudly, right? And you'll know that they're tired and bored, and it's like, oh my gosh. So anyway, it's a fun, everything about making books for kids is fun.
Kids will let you know exactly where you stand for better or worse. So, what does your writing process look like then? I imagine it would vary based on the work that you're doing and the type of project you're working on. How does that shake out for your day to day?
Well, between the picture books and the novels that I write, there are some consistencies actually between the two. For example, I do this thing we call story mapping, where I'm basically plotting the story. And I started doing that with picture books, where I would do this kind of a flow chart to figure out the sequence of events for my picture book. And when I started working on the Wild Robot books, that story mapping technique was so helpful that I decided, of course, this would work for a novel also. So I story mapped. I probably spent a year mapping out the story for The Wild Robot, the first book in the series, because first of all, I was dragging my feet a little bit because I had never written a novel before and was kind of nervous and didn't know if I had the skills to pull it off. So I was like, I want to understand every little detail in this entire thing before I really dive into the writing. So I spent a lot of time mapping out the story, which is a technique that really works for my way of thinking. And then and then after that, things get a little different. Like with a picture book, I'm bouncing back and forth between sketching illustrations, figuring out what each scene is going to look like visually. And then I figure out what are the words that I need to fill in the gaps, right? Like what can't this picture do? And then I use words to do what can't be done with the illustrations. And sometimes the illustrations can do everything, and I don't have any words on that particular page, right? Whereas in a novel, obviously the words are doing the heavy lifting. Even though my novels have some illustrations, it's more about the words. And so for them, after I've mapped out the whole story and I understand what's going to happen in every chapter, I outline everything, and I might outline every plot point on my outline is its own chapter. And so I have a lot of chapters. My books typically have like 80 or 90 chapters. And it works for me to know this is the goal of chapter 3. This is the goal of chapter 20, right? This is what has to happen in chapter 32. And then I dive in, and I that's kind of where the how would I say this? I don't know exactly what's going to happen once I dive into chapter 32. Like, I know
right,
what I
yeah.
need. I know what I need. The goal of the chapter is clear to me, but how I get there is still kind of up for me to figure out, you know? And so that can be a little scary sometimes if I'm not quite sure how I'm going to make it work, or it can be, you know, pretty straightforward if I know exactly how I want to get from point A to point B in that particular chapter. So yeah, I don't know. I don't really know what I'm doing. Like, I didn't study writing much. And so I kept thinking to myself, there's probably systems in place. Like, if I had studied writing more seriously, I probably would have addressed these various ways, you know, mapping out a story and,
yeah,
and the writing process. There's probably, like, people have figured this stuff out. And yet here I am kind of reinventing the wheel because I didn't know any better, you know?
Yeah. So. I don't know. I mean, yes, there's like a lot of different ways to tackle it, but you know, I mean, it depends on who you talk to, right? Like, some authors just sort of write with the end in mind, and that's their map, is just, you know, this is how the story is going to end. What's going to happen in between? We don't know.
Yeah. Oh man, I could, you know? Oh, it sounds terrifying to me.
Yeah. I've done it that way. Yes. I do not, zero stars, do not recommend. It's not great. I like the idea of story mapping though. I mean, I know a lot of people call it plotting and it's probably very similar, but I do like the idea of your outline as a map.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to doing your picture books, and even you said that Wild Robot has some illustrations in it, do you include illustrations? Like, do you start with like an image in mind? I guess I'm kind of curious about how the art element of storytelling and then the word part of storytelling kind of works in your brain. I think it's quite fascinating.
Well, with picture books, it's always kind of different, you know. Like, I wrote and illustrated a picture book called The Curious Garden, which is about a boy in a gray, dreary city who becomes a gardener, and he starts growing these like wildflowers all over the place, and other people get involved, and the whole city transforms into this garden city. But that whole thing started with just me walking around New York City where I lived at the time. I discovered the High Line before it became a park. It was just this kind of abandoned elevated railway with weeds and wildflowers and trees and stuff growing. And I was starting to notice like where things, like little plants were growing in cracks in the sidewalk. And I just started noticing how nature pops up in kind of surprising places. And so I started filling my sketchbook with drawings of those types of scenes, you know, just like a little forest growing on top of a skyscraper, you know,
yeah.
like buildings being completely abandoned, buildings completely overgrown with like vines and weeds. And like those scenes, my sketchbooks were just filled with that. And I didn't really know where the story was going, but I gradually kind of pieced it together and started imagining myself as the kid discovering a place kind of like this. And slowly but surely the story came together, but it all started with drawings and sketches in my sketchbook. Other times, you know, I wrote and illustrated a picture book called Children Make Terrible Pets. And that started with a sentence, right? Like, that started with a sentence. I won't remember the wording exactly, but it was basically like, a wild animal brings home a boy to be its pet, something like that. Because I was thinking about when I was a kid and I would bring like little turtles and frogs and stuff home to my house to be a pet that I'd find out in the woods. And I thought it'd be funny to kind of reverse the roles and have a boy be the one who's brought home to be a pet for this wild animal. And so the bear named Lucy finds him. Anyway, you know, so every picture book is different. And yeah, I never know exactly where the ideas are going to come or how they're going to come together. One of the really exciting things about making picture books is that as both an author and an illustrator, it is unpredictable. Like, I don't know how I'm going to spend my day. I might think I'm going to spend it writing, but I end up spending it drawing, or, you know, or doing research or something like that. And it's because I can both write and illustrate that I can bounce back and forth between these two different parts of the picture book. That is a lot of fun. And it gives me a lot of creative freedom.
Yeah. And you also do collaborations where someone else writes the story and you illustrate the books. How does that partnership work?
You know, it's funny. So I've done that a few times, mostly with an author named Aaron Reynolds. We do this creepy series of picture books. And actually we have a spinoff series of early readers, creepy early readers that are coming out starting in September. But those are really fun because they're much less stressful for me. when I'm doing everything, it's all on me, and I get nervous that I'm going to make a mistake, and it can be a little daunting at times. But when I work with Aaron, he writes the whole manuscript, and he's flexible enough. He knows that once I start illustrating it, we can revisit the text. Maybe some descriptions won't be necessary because I'm showing it clearly in the illustrations, so he's not like the text isn't absolutely set in stone, but it's pretty finished when I get it. And I get to kind of have fun figuring out how to visualize this story and hopefully finding ways of enhancing the text, adding some details that may not be in the text, but make the text even more interesting. Sometimes it can be really fun if the illustrations and the text conflict with each other, right? Like if the text says one thing and the picture shows something very different, that can be really funny if it work if you do it right, and so it's not just that I'm taking his words and absolutely mirroring what the words say. I'm trying to expand upon them, add to them, enhance it in some way with the pictures. That's the goal anyway.
Yeah, that
So that
sounds
can be a lot of fun. And like I said, it's a lot less stressful. So it's been great for me in the last few years because I've kind of bounced between Wild Robot books and these creepy books with Aaron. The Wild Robot books are all mine, but they're also really stressful. And so when I'm finished with one of those, then I illustrate one of these creepy books for Aaron, and it's so much less stressful and it's just kind of fun. It's like a different part of my brain. So I feel really lucky that I get to have both of these projects,
Yeah, that sounds like a nice balance, like a nice
It
outlet.
is.
Yeah. Well,
Yeah.
speaking of the Wild Robot, that book has enjoyed tremendous success from publication to now the movie. And now you are releasing an adaptation of the adaptation, taking the middle grade novels into picture book form. How did that come about?
Well, it's funny, when I first wrote The Wild Robot, the novel, I thought at the very beginning, I thought it might be a picture book because that's the only kind of book I'd ever made. I just had this idea about a robot in the wilderness, and I figured, well, I'll figure out how to turn this into a picture book. But as I did research and a lot of thinking and writing and exploring with my ideas, I realized that the ideas in my novel in The Wild Robot were really interesting and layered and complex, too big to fit into a picture book. And so I decided to write my first novel. And then I wrote a few more Wild Robot novels. But with time and a little space, a little distance between me, I've started to see how I could possibly retell Roz the Robot's like origin story in a more visual picture book format. I didn't see that in the beginning right away. It took a little time, but I realize now, like, what are the absolute key moments in the story that are essential for this whole idea to make sense, And can I strip everything else away except for those really essential moments? And does that work as a story on its own? And it turns out that it does. It's a different story, it's a much simpler story, of course. But I was excited about the idea of revisiting that world and showing readers how Roz becomes the wild robot rather than telling them how she becomes the wild robot with words, right? Like, I know the whole like rule, like show, don't tell with writing, and I absolutely believe that. But you know what I'm trying to say is like the words are explaining how Roz becomes the wild robot in the actual novel. But I thought, let's show readers exactly what I see in my imagination. And because when I was writing the novel, I was seeing everything pretty clearly in my mind. Colors, textures, different plants and compositions, scenes where Roz is sitting a certain way in a certain place. But I could only sprinkle illustrations throughout the novel. With the picture book, I really got to dive in and fully show readers what I'm seeing in my own mind. And that to me was really exciting. I thought it'd be a great way for younger readers to be introduced to the wild robot world, and hopefully readers who are actually already fans of the novels will enjoy seeing Roz in a whole new way, up close and personal and detail and color. I really pushed color as far as much as I could. The illustrations in the novels are black and white. except for the cover art. Everything else is black and white. So I thought, well, if I'm going to do this picture book, color's got to be really important. Like I gotta push it as far as I can and make the color really interesting and powerful. And, you know, so it was a fun creative challenge for me. And obviously there's a lot of love for the Wild Robot these days. And so I thought, you know, maybe readers would actually want something like this. And so I decided to go for it.
Yeah, I think that's great. Well, my nephew is a huge fan of both the novel and the movie. And he had a question that he had asked me when he first saw the movie, because he knows that I do books. He's very excited to find out I was talking to you about the mama bear and the two cubs turning into the grumpy old man bear in the movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hot topic there for
oh, man.
For the young ones.
Well, God, you know, it's such a weird thing to have a movie based on my book, or for an author to have a movie based on their book. It's so exciting. I feel so lucky. It's drawn so much attention to the books, you know. But they mess with the story. Like they don't translate it one-to-one. It's like, and they can't really, like, it's an impossible task because they're very different art forms. Some changes are absolutely inevitable, and as the author and the illustrator of the books, I just have to sort of grin and bear it, you know, because there's nothing I can do. I'm not working on the movie. I had a lot of conversations with the filmmakers throughout the 4 years it took them to make the animated film, you know, where they were asking me questions and picking my brain and trying to understand all of my decisions that I made with the books. But then they go off and they make their own version of that idea, of that kind of basic concept, you know? So one of the changes was the bears. There's other characters. One of my favorite characters from the novels is a squirrel named Chit Chat, and there's no Chit Chat in the movie. And that's a bummer, even though I told them many times that Chit Chat was important to the readers and to me. And I thought, you should try to find a way, and they tried to find a way to include Chit Chat, but they just couldn't, because they have to streamline this thing as much as they possibly can. And that's what happened with the bears. They thought, do we really need three bears? Maybe we can condense these three different bear characters kind of into one bear character and have that single character do the stuff basically that the three did in the book. And it's not a crazy idea, right? Like, if you're looking to streamline the story, that seems kind of like a reasonable change to make. And so that's what they did. And so Mama Bear and Nettle and Thorn, her two cubs, became one bear character named Thorn, who is, like kind of an old man bear character, kind of grumpy. I will say Mark Hamill did the voice for Thorn, the bear. And so that made me feel a little better about Thorn, because I love Mark Hamill, and so that was pretty sweet.
Well, Duncan is a big Star Wars fan too, so it hurt a little bit less, I think.
Yeah, for
me nice,
too.
A nice little, like, well, we're sorry about that.
Right.
So, what has been the biggest surprise over the course of your career?
Oh, that's a good one. Let's see. I think the biggest surprise for me has been the Wild Robot, for sure. You know, it's by far my most successful book and series. And I wasn't sure when I was writing it if anybody was going to care, if anybody was going to like it. You know, I remember talking to my editor just before the book was published back in 2016. And I was just like, what is going to happen? Is anybody going to understand what I'm trying to do with this story? And she was like, I don't know. She was like, she said, to be fair, she was like, Peter, I think you did a great job. I love this story, but you know, the market is fickle. Like, you never know what's going to happen. Yeah. And what's been really surprising and really heartening to me is that these young readers really love these characters and these stories, and the stories go to really surprising places. There's a lot of depth that you wouldn't expect in the Wild Robot series, which was one of the reasons I wanted to make it in the first place, was to surprise readers with how much they feel in a robot story, how much emotion gets dredged up in these different scenes because they're relatable. And it's been surprising and heartening to see readers, young readers, really get it and really understand and really not only can they handle it, but they want it. They want the truth. They want depth. You know, they want to be told. They don't want to be sugarcoated. They don't want things to be sugarcoated, you know. And I didn't sugarcoat things. You know, there's death in these books. There's family separation. There's issues of bullying and assimilation into different communities. Like it goes to some really shocking places, and these young kids just eat it up. And so that was, I didn't know if that was going to happen, you know.
Yeah.
And it surprised me when it happened to such an extraordinary degree. And it's changed my life. I mean, those books absolutely changed my life with the success and the attention and the, obviously the sales and the financial side of things is great. And it wouldn't have happened if young readers weren't up to the challenge of what I was trying to do with this weird story about a robot becoming a single mom in the wilderness for a goose. It's like, what? Why? I don't know.
Well, you know, it happens. You know?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, the way I think reason why kids are into it is because I walk them through the step-by-step process, right? What seems like a completely outlandish idea, I say, well, here's the baby steps. Here's how we got from point A to point B. I don't just throw you into the thick of it. I say, here's a robot that looks and seems like what you would expect a robot to be. And now we're going to watch this gradual progression as she gradually becomes wild and natural and learns to speak with these animals and develops relationships with the animals, including adopting an orphan gosling, and eventually becomes the wild robot. Like, I'm holding their hand. I'm walking them through this process, but they're so into it that it's like, it still kind of blows my mind that I got away with this.
Well, yeah, I know, you know, my nephew, but a lot of kids just really, really adore the book, the movie, all of it. So you touched on this a little bit, but because you are writing to kids, I think that this question is a little more poignant perhaps than it is for people who are writing to adults. But what do you hope your readers take away from your work?
Yeah, I think about this a lot. You know, being an author of any kind of book is an opportunity to put your energy into the universe, right? To put your ideas out there. And, you know, I want kids to basically be open-minded and curious and kind. And I want them to laugh. You know, I want them to be like rich, have rich, full lives. But man, I look at the world today and I just think, what happened, man? Where did we go wrong? Because there is some mixed messages. For years, we've told kids that bullying is bad. You go into elementary schools and you see posters about it, and there's like workshops and everybody's talking about how bullying is bad. And then we live in a world now where we see a lot of bullies in the limelight, in the spotlight. And so what are kids supposed to do with that, right? Like, what, how are they supposed to navigate this whole situation? And so I really try hard with my books to show kids the value of being kind to each other and being open-minded and curious, you know? Like, you don't have to understand everything. It's okay to ask questions, right? Like, ask questions, make mistakes. But if you can come with from a place of like sort of a generous spirit, like a kindness behind your questions, you can't really go wrong, you know? And so I'm constantly trying to push that sort of positivity into my books and into kids' minds. And it sounds cliche, but we need it, you know? Yeah. We need it. So I'm like all for it. If it's cliche, I'm guilty. I don't care. Like, let's pull ourselves together and be decent to each other. Because that seems to be slipping away a little bit.
Yeah, I love that. And I definitely think that that comes across very clearly in your work. As we are reaching the end, we do always like to cap our interviews off with this question. What's one piece of advice you'd give to newer aspiring writers?
You know what really helps me is, and this makes a little more sense for kids authors, but I think this holds true for all authors, is I read my words out loud all the time. I'm constantly reading my stuff out loud because it forces me to recognize where there's little speed bumps in my writing. If I'm literally tripping, if my tongue is having a hard time saying a combination of words, I think to myself, well, maybe I'll just change those combination of words and make that smooth that out. And what happens is a lot of people, when they're reading, they're kind of, they might be mouthing the words a little bit. Like, I think even if they're reading silently, I still think there's value to taking that extra step of smoothing out the way your words sound. It forces you to think a little differently about your wording. And I think one of the reasons my Wild Robot books have been so successful is that kids tell me that the books are really fun to listen to, being read aloud to them. But they can read them on their own because I've polished everything off. Everything is like a smooth experience for the reader. And to me, that's important. I want kids to keep reading, and the experience of reading has to be fun for them and not any harder than it needs to be. I don't want them struggling. I don't want it to be feel like a chore. And I think a lot of adult readers are the same way. I mean, how many adult read, how many kids, how many adults actually read books that fully book, from the start to finish anymore? I don't know, not as many as should as there should be. So
I agree with
might,
that.
maybe there's some value to treating adults a little more like kids in the way that you write for them, So.
I agree with that. I do think that I read my books out loud from start to finish, which is quite the adventure on your vocal cords, but you do,
Yeah.
your ear catches things that your eyes will sort of skip over, and so that's a good piece of advice. Well, thank you so much for
Nice.
being here today. I just had such a delightful time talking to you, and I hope everyone continues to enjoy your books and your series, and if more Wild Robot movies are on the way, I'm sure the world would love that too.
Stay tuned. I think there's a lot more Wild Robot stuff coming down the pipeline. So, yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
This was such a interesting conversation, just because I don't know that we've had like a lot of picture book and kidlet specific interviews, but the idea of using like actual drawings to like map your story, I thought was like fun and interesting. Do you guys like draw or do anything that would even be remotely like quote unquote artistic
Oh yeah.
other than the writing?
I believe we have discussed my stick figures.
Hey, you can do a lot with stick figures. There's an account
You
on
can.
Bookstagram who does all book stick figures.
I draw and have for a while. I used to want to be a comic book artist when I was a kid. That's one of the jobs that I
Fascinating,
n
Kevin.
never quite went into. And somehow I'm connected to a ton of people in the comic book industry. And still can't find a way to crack in. So,
Would you ever do illustrations in your book? Because I know sometimes special editions will do that, even with adult titles. Like Stephen King books will end up like with some illustrations, which I think is an interesting thing to think about. Would you guys ever do that in your books?
I think I would.
Even if I could draw, I don't know that I would do it.
What's the hang up, JD? Why would you not
Yeah,
want to do it?
I don't know. It feels like a very different skill set. I've never been that good as far as drawing, so that's
Well,
probably it.
would you use someone else's art in your
Yeah,
book?
I think I might do that. I mean, my main concern there is, like even when I write a story, I try not to describe characters and places too much. Like I just plant a couple of the seeds because I prefer to rely on the subconscious of whoever's reading to fill in those like the visual gaps. Because one of the things I learned very early on is if you tell a person what a character looks like, their mind is already made up what that person looks like. And now all of a sudden you're taking them out of the story. And it's funny because like I put very little detail when it comes to that, but a lot of my reviews say that my books are very visual and they draw this out, draw that out. It's really coming from their own mind. I think what I find unique about this though is like Peter is doing his own illustrations. So he's basically got the perfect trifecta of stuff going on because, not only is he a really good children's writer, which is very difficult to do to write to that particular audience, but his actual drawings grab the kids just as much as the his written words do. Because he mentioned the other series where he just does illustrations, and you know, like that series is a, you know, a fan favorite over at our elementary school. And you know, the kids have no clue who the actual author is or who's drawing those pictures, but those books are flying off the shelf. So there's something there that grabs them, something in his drawings, and you know, and he's got the words and the story, like all, you know, he's, like I said, the trifecta.
I do think it's really interesting what you just said. Like in picture books, the pictures actually act as a part of the story. But when you go to adult books, even the ones that have like illustrations in them, the illustrations are almost like extra, you know, it's like fan art almost instead of actually like being a cohesive part of the story. It's just so interesting to add another layer to storytelling, I guess. And I wonder if you could do that in an adult book. I don't, maybe you can't, maybe it's a comic
you know
book.
I was thinking that we do it, but like differently, because I think when we talk about books being cinematic, it's like, what do I really want the reader to see in their mind with this scene? And it may not be like what somebody looks like, but it's the concrete visual details of that scene. And I think, you know, he talked about that maybe a little bit with goals of the scene too. What's the goal of the scene? What's it look like from a camera shot? And then what words do I need to fill that in? I think we kind of do the same thing.
You know, Kurt Vonnegut, I just finished rereading Slaughterhouse-Five, which I hadn't read in years, but he would occasionally do these little doodles that went in his books. And this one is no exception.
I could actually see where this would work, because if you're, you know, you're writing a scene, you get stuck, you know, maybe you start to doodle, you know, and you start drawing out these little things, and then maybe that trips your brain into getting you to that next place. So I could see that working.
I've drawn out things for like maps of like houses when I'm doing a scene, like, where's this room?
I do that too. Especially for like, apartments and houses and anything where you're gonna have to refer to, you know, kitchen is over here, bedrooms over here, that kind of stuff.
I don't know if this qualifies or not, but like I do, one of the ways that I sort of mentally finish a book is to create a cover, whether that cover ends up being the one used or not. Like I sort of illustrate something that's in my head that not necessarily a scene from the book, because that doesn't usually make a good cover, but the sort of essence of the story. So that's part of what I do. And a lot of times that does end up being the cover, honestly.
Yeah. I think that's, I mean, you know, it's sort of like, I know people, I have a friend who does like mood boards, you know, for drafts and stuff. And it's just sort of like, you know, this mashup of different images that just sort of like have the vibes. And for a while on Twitter, they had like pitch contests where, you know, that was like a way that you could include, you know, like a little graphic of these different images to like kind of help sell your idea. So it is an interesting way of just adding to the creativity, I think.
Yeah. A lot of people post those on Pinterest. After the fact. And honestly, like I've been using, you know, playing with the various like ChatGPT and Grok and stuff for visuals. So like I'll take a character description that I've created, drop it into Grok and say, give me a picture of this person. I've done the same thing where I've dropped in a scene, like I'm writing a book right now that takes place in a cabin. So I dropped in the first chapter and had Grok give me a picture of what that cabin looks like. And I've got it up on a TV in my office where I can actually, you know, just kind of glance up and see it, and kind of just, you know, helps me stay grounded in the story to be able to see those same faces and the you know, places and things like that. I suppose I probably should put all that up on Pinterest, because that's what everybody else does. I just have never done that before.
I think it's kind of interesting, like, because you think about like fan art and stuff, and you know, there's people who, you know, they really like when a series gets popular, a book gets popular, like the first thing you start seeing is, you know, their own drawings. And sometimes you look at a drawing and you think like, yeah, I get it. And sometimes you're like, wow, like that's not how I saw the character at all. And I think like, no matter what the reaction is, it's just so interesting how people react and interact with it. And I suppose that's the same thing with kids. I did love what he said about kids being a brutal audience.
that's the thing. I mean, kids are tough, you know, like anybody who's got a kid, like, you know, with like children's books, like you may think it's the greatest book ever as an adult when you pick it up at the store, you bring it home and your kid hears it one time and it's done. And then you've got this other book that, you know, the story means nothing to you as an adult, your child wants to hear it, you know, 200 times, like they just can't get enough of it. And again, you know, like Peter somehow managed to grab that magic formula because they eat up those words. Like I've literally seen like the teacher at my daughter's second grade class reading Wild Robot, and those kids are just staring at her,
Yeah.
completely mesmerized by that story.
Are you guys brave enough to ask a room full of 8-year-olds their honest opinion about you? I don't know if I am.
Yeah, I got no problem with it.
Oh, I get them all the time in my job. I get their honest opinions. So I work with kids.
That's true, you do.
I've done some talks at schools, middle schools, and things like that.
Middle
You
school are not 8-year-olds. Middle school is
know,
when they're
I've got some.
starting to learn that they actually have to be socially polite. 8-year-olds are like third grade, and like they're the group that, like, if you're talking and they're bored, will loudly yawn or like say in their full outside voice, "I'm bored. When is this going to be over?"
Well, to be fair,
Christine
that's
knows. I know, believe me, I know.
whenever I watch a movie or something with Kara, I got to deal with that same thing. She's always telling me how bored she is. So I'm used to that.
Okay, that's good. JD, who's up next week?
Wow. Next week, we've got Ewan Morrison coming on. He's an award-winning novelist and screenwriter. He also writes for The Guardian, The Times, and The Daily Mail. His latest novel is called For Emma, which releases on June 17th.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.